Picture this, right? You're sitting at a dinner party.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
And it is loud. Like the kind of loud where the acoustics of the room are just, they're just bouncing every single sound straight back at you.
Oh yeah, the worst kind of room.
Exactly. Plates are clinking. There are like three different conversations crossing over your plate. Someone down at the end of the table is laughing way too hard.
Right, and the ambient music is probably just a little too heavy on the bass.
Yes. It's completely overwhelming. You are totally sensory overloaded.
Uh-huh.
But then someone sits down in the empty chair right next to you, and they don't raise their voice to compete with the room. They don't like slam a hand on the table to demand your attention.
They just kind of exist in the space.
Right. They just lean in, they look you dead in the center of your eyes, and they quietly say, "Think of a childhood memory."
Oh, wow.
And in that fraction of a second, the entire chaotic room just, well, it just fades away.
Yeah, the background noise just completely drops out of your perceptual reality at that
Yeah.
point. Your focus narrows to this tiny pinprick. The only thing that exists in the world is the voice of the person sitting next to you and the images that are flashing behind your own eyes. You're entirely helplessly captivated.
It feels like pure magic, like someone literally just cast a spell on you.
Yeah.
But the stack of materials we are looking at today for this deep dive, they argue that there is absolutely nothing supernatural happening.
Not even a little bit.
No. Instead, it is a highly engineered, meticulously rehearsed hack of your perceptual system.
It really is.
So today we are opening up a massive treasure trove of sources. We've got our hands on these underground mentalism manuals, performance theory essays written by master illusionists, and some intensely detailed psychological breakdowns of, well, sleight of mind.
Yeah, sleight of mind is a great way to put it.
Our mission for this deep dive into all this source material is to unpack that secret intersection where psychological manipulation meets high theatrical artistry.
We are essentially going to be looking under the hood of human perception. I mean, the texts we've gathered, they provide this fascinating blend of raw, almost mechanical psychological techniques.
Like step-by-step instructions.
Exactly. How to literally force a human being to make a specific choice, or how to read involuntary physiological tells, even how to split reality into two completely different timelines in a single room.
Which is just wild to even think about.
It is. But what makes this material so incredibly rich is that it pairs those clinical psychological mechanics with a really profound dramatic philosophy.
Right, so it's not just a how-to guide.
No, this isn't just a tutorial on how a card trick works. It is a masterclass in the inevitable architecture of human belief. We're going to explore the nuts and bolts of the illusions for sure, but we're going to spend a lot of time on the why.
The why is so important here.
Because why does applying classic dramatic theory, take a cheap puzzle you bought at a joke shop, and elevate it into a moment of profound tear-inducing wonder?
Okay, let's unpack this. Because going through these performance essays, I gotta say, they take everything you and I probably think we know about magic and completely flip it on its head.
They really do.
The core argument here, which hits you right in the first few pages, is that most standard magic, like the kind you see on TV specials or, I don't know, at a kid's birthday party, is actually just fundamentally bad drama.
Bad drama. That's the perfect phrase because it violates almost every rule of compelling storytelling.
How so?
Well, if we step back and look at the classical structure of theater, dating all the way back to the ancient Greeks, a compelling narrative requires a hero.
Right, you need someone to root for.
Exactly. And a hero, by definition, must have a clear purpose, they must face a daunting conflict, and crucially, they must be vulnerable.
Vulnerable, that's the key word.
Yes. We, as the audience, invest our emotions in that vulnerability. We connect with their struggle. But when we look at standard magic performances, the performer rarely acts like a vulnerable
Oh,
hero.
totally. They usually act like an omnipotent god. They just, snap their fingers and a dove materializes out of thin air. Or they wave a shiny stick and a heavy wooden box floats into the rafters.
Nothing is hard for them.
Exactly. There's no struggle.
And that is the problem. Playing an omnipotent god is fundamentally unbelievable, and frankly, it's boring.
Yeah, there is zero human conflict.
The materials actually quote the brilliant illusionist teller on this exact subject. He makes the point that the depiction of a god is capricious and trivial. If the magician is in a position of ultimate godlike power, there isn't a flicker of humanity for the audience to latch onto.
Because they're just showing off.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And because we, the audience, know intellectually that this person standing in front of us in a sequined vest isn't actually an immortal deity bending the laws of physics.
Right. We know it's a trick.
Exactly. So the only logical response our brain can muster is a defensive one. We think, okay, how did you do that trick? Where is the trap door?
You're not telling a story. You're just presenting them with a puzzle to solve.
Precisely. A puzzle.
It makes me think of playing a video game, right? Like when you turn on the invincibility cheese.
Yeah, the God mode.
Yeah, God mode. You have unlimited ammo, you can't take damage, you can fly. And sure, it is hilarious to run around blowing everything up for about, I don't know, 60 seconds.
But then it gets old fast.
It becomes entirely hollow. You turn the game off because there are no stakes. If you cannot lose, winning means absolutely nothing.
That is a perfect analogy.
So the alternative these texts propose is that the magician needs to act as a vulnerable hero, someone who is just as surprised by the magic as we are, or someone who is providing this very precarious, difficult link to a secondary world of wonder.
Right. They're the conduit, not the source.
There is a specific example in the text that perfectly illustrates this, comparing the classic floating bill trick to a routine called the floating ring.
Oh, that comparison is the absolute distillation of this entire philosophy.
Let's break it down.
Let's look at the traditional floating bill first. A magician walks up, asks you for a dollar bill, crumbles it up, maybe waves their hands around it mysteriously, and the money floats in the air.
And the immediate reaction from the audience is analytical.
Completely analytical. They're looking for strings, asking where the wire is, wondering if he switched the bill.
It's a challenge to the intellect.
But the floating ring routine totally changes the stakes by anchoring the physical illusion to an emotional reality.
This routine blew my mind when I read the breakdown. So instead of a random piece of paper currency, the performer asks a spectator, let's imagine a woman sitting at our chaotic dinner party from earlier.
Okay, we're back at the party.
The performer asks her to take off one of her own rings, something she wears every single day, a piece of jewelry that already has personal weight, maybe even sentimental value.
It's deeply personal right from the start.
Yeah. The performer places it on the palm of their hand and then asks her to connect that specific ring to a deeply held happy memory from her own life.
And this is where the psychology comes in. The performer begins to guide her through a visualization. They ask her to isolate that positive emotion, that warmth of the memory, and picture it as a white light glowing inside of her chest.
A white light?
Yeah. They instruct her to see that light swirling, gathering energy, and to consciously make that feeling grow and spread through her entire body.
And the genius of the script here is the misdirection of attention.
Right, it's not about the hands.
The performer tells her to keep her eyes focused on the ring. But as she makes that positive feeling move inside her, the ring physically twitches on the performer's open palm.
It reacts to her.
And what's wild is the performer actively tells her to ignore the ring.
Hmm.
They say, no, don't look at the metal. Keep your mind on the feeling. Push the feeling outward.
Which just makes her focus on it more.
Exactly. The ring starts sliding around on the hand, vibrating. And finally, the performer says, I want you to understand what people mean when they talk about their heart soaring.
Wow.
And the ring physically lifts off the hand and floats up into the air between them.
Notice the shift in causality here, because this is vital. In the floating bill, the cause of the magic was the magician's ego.
Right. Look what I can do.
Exactly. It was their godlike will forcing the universe to obey them. But in this routine, the cause of the levitation is metaphorical.
It's driven by her emotion.
The ring floats because her positive emotion is soaring. The magic is presented as a physical manifestation of her internal emotional state. The performer isn't doing the magic. They are just facilitating an environment where her emotions can manipulate reality.
I have to stop you there, though, because I'm putting myself in the shoes of someone listening to this, and my skeptical alarm bells are just ringing.
Okay, let's hear it.
Isn't the audience smart enough to know the ring is still just a trick? I mean, they know she isn't literally lifting a piece of silver with her happy thoughts. The intellectual part of the brain has to be screaming, hey, there's a hidden thread.
And that conflict between the intellect and the emotion is the exact battleground where great mentalism takes place.
So they do know.
Does the intellect know it's an illusion? Yes, of course. But the emotional response being elicited is so powerful, so deeply resonant with human experience, that it temporarily overrides the analytical mind.
It just shuts it down.
The audience actively chooses to suspend their disbelief because the emotional journey of the narrative is so incredibly satisfying.
That makes a lot of sense.
When she takes the ring back, she isn't frantically searching for a microfiber thread. She is clasping the performer's hand in gratitude because she just experienced a moment of pure, uninterrupted wonder.
The emotional truth of the moment eclipses the factual truth of the method.
Perfectly said.
It's almost like the brain says, look, logic, I hear you, but we are going to put you on mute for 5 minutes because this feels amazing.
That's exactly what happened.
But reading through these manuals, it becomes very clear that you can't just walk up to a table of strangers eating appetizers and expect them to immediately go on a deep, vulnerable, emotional journey with you.
Definitely not.
To get them to that point of compliance, the performer has to fundamentally control the environment and the social dynamic from the very first syllable they speak.
Controlling the space is paramount.
Yeah.
The essays are absolutely adamant about this. Let's go back to your opening scenario of the loud, chaotic dinner party or maybe a corporate networking event.
Right. Tons of distractions.
If a performer walks into that environment and tries to frantically adapt to their loud, chaotic energy, like if they raise their voice, talk fast, and try to be the life of the party, they become just another loud distraction in a room full of loud distractions.
You're just a mingling jester at that point.
Exactly. The text argues that the performer must instead quietly gain rapport and then elegantly, almost invisibly, force the entire group to adapt to their serious, focused terms.
The meticulous crafting of the opening approach is fascinating. There is a specific introductory script provided in the text that seems so simple, but it's apparently a psychological weapon.
Oh, the introduction.
Yeah. The performer walks up, makes eye contact, and says, hi, I'm a kind of magician.
The power of that sentence lives entirely in the deliberate pause. A kind of.
It creates this immediate dangling curiosity. Because if you walk up and say, hi, I'm a magician, everyone at the table immediately accesses their mental file folder for magician.
And we all know what's in that folder.
Right. It usually contains a guy in a cheap suit, a top hat, maybe a sponge ball, and a feeling of being tricked or made to look foolish, their guard instantly goes up.
But by saying a kind of magician, you short-circuit that assumption.
Yes. You introduce a pattern interrupt. They're forced to think, wait, what does a kind of mean? Is he a psychic? Is he a psychological hacker? Is he dangerous?
You are demanding interpretative work from the audience before the first defect has even begun. You are making them lean in.
And once the performer has created that vacuum of attention, they have to maintain that intense, quiet control.
Which requires immense internal discipline. And that brings us to a concept outlined in the text called the silent script, which was famously utilized by the legendary Dutch illusionist Tommy Wonder.
Oh, the vanishing ball example in the text for this concept is incredible.
It's one of the best examples of internal congruence.
The idea is that when a performer is doing a piece of sleight of hand, let's say they are pretending to place a red ball into their left hand, but they are secretly retaining it in their right hand, they cannot just mechanically go through the physical motions.
Right. If you just practice the hand movements in a mirror, it will always look like a trick.
Exactly. Instead, they have to run a silent script in their head. The manual says the performer must vividly, aggressively imagine the ball sitting in their empty left hand. They have to literally think the words, now vanish, my boy, as they open the hand.
They have to hallucinate the ball.
Yes, they hallucinate the ball losing its color, becoming transparent, and fading away into the air.
And the necessity of this really comes down to the sheer impossibility of consciously controlling the thousands of micro-expressions on the human face.
Because we leak information all the time.
Constantly. If the performer's internal monologue is, okay, I've got the ball hidden in my right hand, keep the thumb tight, don't drop it, their eyes will subtly flick to the right hand.
Even if they don't mean to.
The tension in their shoulders will shift. The musculature around their mouth will betray deception. The human brain is highly evolved to detect deceit.
We are so good at spotting fakes.
But if the performer genuinely, vividly believes in the magic at the exact moment it is supposed to happen, their neurology aligns. That absolute psychological congruence translates to the audience.
So the audience's mirror neurons fire.
Exactly. They feel the impossibility because the performer is feeling it.
It's way beyond acting. It's almost like a temporary localized illusion.
Yeah.
If you don't believe it's real in your own bones, the audience will never feel it's real.
That psychological congruence ties into a much broader theatrical principle discussed in these performance essays, which is the concept of withholding power.
I love the cinematic comparison made in the text for this.
It perfectly captures the idea. Think of Anthony Hopkins' portrayal of Hannibal Lecter in The Silence of the Lambs, compared to Christopher Walken's Headless Horseman in Sleepy Hollow.
That is such a visceral analogy, because the Headless Horseman is running around the woods, screaming, chopping people's heads off with a flaming sword.
It's loud, it's frantic.
It's incredibly explicit power.
But is it terrifying in a way that stays with you? Not really. It's spectacle. Now look at Hannibal Lecter. He is terrifying precisely because of what he isn't doing.
He just sits perfectly still in a glass cell.
He speaks politely. He barely blinks. The implied power that is confidently withheld is infinitely more terrifying and infinitely more fascinating than over-the-top, explicitly stated power.
So how does that apply to a mentalist?
Well, if a performer walks on stage and explicitly states, "I'm going to use my amazing psychic powers to read your minds and control your thoughts," the audience instantly becomes cynical. The challenge is accepted.
They want to prove him wrong.
But if the performer remains quiet, intense, slightly reserved, and merely implies through their actions that they possess a deep, slightly unnerving understanding of how your brain works,
the audience leans in. They fill in the blank spaces with their own imagination. And whatever the audience imagines you are capable of will always be more powerful than whatever you can actually do.
Always.
So let's look at the progression here. The performer has approached the table. They've used a pattern interrupt to gain focused attention. They are totally congruent in their micro expressions, and they are withholding their power to create an aura of mystery.
Now the real work begins.
Now they can actually begin to hack the minds of the spectators. Let's get into the mechanics of subliminal communication. How do you actually make a human being choose exactly what you want them to choose while leaving them absolutely convinced they had total free will?
We are entering the realm of subliminal forcing, and this entirely relies on exploiting a very specific bottleneck in how the human brain processes information, which is cognitive load.
Cognitive load.
Yes. The conscious mind, the part of you that parses language and logic, has a very limited bandwidth. When that conscious mind is heavily occupied with processing rapid-fire, direct verbal instructions, the subconscious mind is left completely unguarded.
It's wide open.
Wide open to absorb physical, visual, and tonal cues.
This is the part of the deep dive where the mechanics get incredibly cool. Hmm. Let's break down the Three of Diamonds force from the manual.
It's a classic.
The scenario is this. The performer absolutely needs the spectator to think of the Three of Diamonds for a massive reveal later on. But obviously, they can't just say, hey, think of the Three of Diamonds.
That'll ruin the trick.
So they deliver a highly calculated, rapid-fire set of instructions. The performer looks at them and says, don't try to guess what card I'm sending you. Don't go for your favorite card. Don't try to catch me out.
Stop right there and analyze the linguistics of that. That is pure cognitive overload.
Because of all the negative commands?
Yes. The conscious mind is suddenly scrambling to parse a barrage of them. Okay, don't guess. What is my favorite card? I need to avoid it. Don't try to outsmart him. Okay, just relax.
So their brain is just spinning.
The working memory is completely maxed out, just trying to follow the rules of the interaction.
And while the spectator's brain is distracted managing those rules, the performer executes an incredibly precise piece of physical choreography.
The secret physical cue.
Yeah. The performer says, imagine a screen in your mind, like that, and they hold both hands up in front of the spectator's face, bringing the thumbs and index fingers together to form a very distinct diamond shape.
A diamond.
Then they say, imagine the little number down at the bottom and up at the top like that. And as they say it, the performer actually draws a backward number 3 in the air with their finger.
So from the spectator's perspective, a perfect 3 is floating in front of them.
Exactly.
It's an aggressive amount of subliminal data, but it slips right past the radar.
Because they're too busy thinking about the rules.
The spectator's conscious mind just registers, oh, the performer's making hand gestures while talking. They do not consciously register the geometric shapes or the specific numbers being traced, because their linguistic processor is still dealing with those negative commands.
And the script keeps going. The performer says, and the things down the middle, the bum, bum, bum down the center of the card. And on the words bum, 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 the performer points 3 times vertically in the air,
mirroring the exact layout of the pips on a 3 card.
Finally, the performer says, make the color bright, strong, and vivid.
Which is a beautiful semantic force for the color red.
Oh, because of the words bright and vivid.
Exactly. If the performer wanted them to construct a black card, the script would shift to make the image dark, heavy, mysterious, like a shadow.
But by using words like bright and vivid, combined with the physical diamond shape, a backward three traced in the air, and three rhythmic vertical points.
The spectator's subconscious is being absolutely saturated with the conceptual building blocks of the Three of Diamonds.
There's another example that I found even more brazen, forcing the Five of Hearts.
That one is very direct physically.
Yeah, the performer is giving instructions and they casually pat their own chest right over their heart while saying, "Feel a suit." Then they open their fists so all five fingers are spread wide, wave it quickly across the spectator's line of sight, and say, "Make it an odd card."
It is a masterful layering of information. The physical spread of the five fingers visually suggests the number five.
And the word odd.
The word odd mathematically eliminates half the deck. But more importantly, the performer slightly alters their vocal tonality on the word odd to make it stick in the auditory memory.
And the padding of the chest is a literal physical anchor to the heart symbol.
Right.
I was reading this and wondering if it's just limited to playing cards, but the text outlines how to force someone to think of a specific letter of the alphabet using almost entirely auditory forcing.
Auditory forcing is wild.
If the performer wants a spectator to think of the letter S, they might ask the person their name. Let's say the person says, "My name is Isabel." The performer repeats it back, but says, "Sorry, did you say Isabel?"
Slightly elongating and stressing the sibilant S sound.
Or if they need the letter M, while the performer is thinking or giving instructions, they literally hum a deep N-N-N-M sound in the back of their throat.
And there is a brilliant piece of psychological elimination embedded in that M force as well. The manual describes a scenario where the performer has secretly written the letter M on a piece of hidden paper.
Right.
As they guide the spectator, they explicitly mention, "I've written the letter down, and I've put a line underneath it to show which way up it should be."
This is so clever because M and W are symmetrical.
Yes, they are.
By stating out loud that there is a line underneath the letter to orient it, the performer is subconsciously feeding the spectator a rule. You are looking for a letter that has a distinct right way up and an upside down.
That subtly, logically nudges the brain away from perfectly symmetrical letters like O, H, or X.
And directly primes the mind to search for directional letters like M or W. Meanwhile, that subtle humming sound is acting like a homing beacon locking them onto the M.
It is a masterclass in exploiting the hierarchy of human perception. The conscious mind simply cannot track the semantic meaning of the sentences, the tonal shifts in the voice, the subtle acoustic hums, and the specific geometry of the hand gestures all at the exact same time.
It's just too much.
The brain is an efficiency machine. It prioritizes the semantic meaning, the actual words being spoken, and allows the tonal and physical data to slip directly into the subconscious.
So a few seconds later, when the performer says, "Name a letter,"
the subconscious hands the conscious mind the letter M, and the spectator genuinely believes it was a spontaneous free choice.
I am looking at the statistics mentioned in the text, though, and it notes that these subliminal forces boast about an 80% success rate.
Which is incredibly high for a psychological nudge.
Now, 80% is incredible for basically performing Jedi mind tricks, but it's not 100%. And in a theatrical setting, what happens when the performer needs a 100% success rate?
They need a sure thing.
Yeah, what happens when they are closing a show and they need to create an absolute, guaranteed, reality-breaking miracle? They can't rely on an 80% suggestion. They have to actively manipulate time and perception itself.
This brings us to one of the most conceptually fascinating and, frankly, philosophically staggering techniques in this entire collection of literature, the concept of dual reality.
Dual reality.
Yes. Yeah. This is the architecture of deception functioning at its absolute highest level.
How does it work?
Dual reality occurs when the audience, as a collective whole, experiences one linear chronological timeline of events, but a specific participant on stage experiences a completely different timeline.
At the same time.
Yes. And the truly brilliant, terrifying part of this architecture is that neither the audience nor the participant realizes there is any discrepancy. They both believe they are experiencing the exact same objective reality.
The ultimate example of this from the manual is a routine called the invisible touch. I want to break down exactly how this works, step by step, because reading it felt like reading the blueprint for a casino heist in an Ocean's 11 movie.
It really requires that level of precision.
The setup is this. The performer asks two friends from the audience, let's call them Amy and Kate, to come up and stand on either side of him. Amy is on his right, Kate is on his left. He tells the audience he is going to test the unseen psychological bond between these two friends.
Oh, the premise is established. Can one friend physically feel what the other friend is feeling through sheer empathetic connection.
Exactly. So the performer turns to Amy on his right and asks her to close her eyes and hold out her hand. The literal millisecond she closes her eyes, the performer tells the audience to look at Kate, who is all the way over on his left.
Directing the attention away from Amy.
Right. He says loudly and clearly, "Kate, watch this." He points his arm dramatically at Kate, steps his body toward her, and as his body turns, his other hand naturally, fluidly sweeps past Amy. In that split second, hidden by his own body turn, he secretly taps Amy's outstretched hand twice.
Now, we must pause time right here and look at the split realities.
Mm-hmm.
At this exact moment, Amy, who has her eyes closed, feels two distinct physical taps on her hand.
She definitely feels it.
But the audience, whose attention was explicitly, aggressively directed away from Amy by the performer's verbal command, Kate, watch this, and his large bodily movement, they entirely miss the subtle fluid motion of the secret tap.
Right. So Amy's internal timeline of the magic trick has already started. She's been tapped. She's standing there with her eyes closed, waiting to see what happens next, already holding the memory of the touch.
But the audience's timeline hasn't even started yet.
Exactly. For the audience, the trip hasn't begun. So a full 10 seconds go by. The performer is now standing far away from Amy. The room is dead silent. He dramatically, slowly reaches out his hand and taps Kate's hand twice.
And this is the moment the audience believes the magic is happening. They watch Kate get tapped in real time, and they naturally assume that this is the precise moment Amy is supposed to feel something telepathically.
The performer then turns back to Amy and asks her to open her eyes. He asks, "Amy, did you feel anything?" Amy says, "Yes, I felt two taps on my hand," and the audience completely loses their minds.
Because the audience saw the performer standing miles away from Amy at the exact moment Kate was tapped. They will swear on their lives he never went anywhere near her.
But Amy knows she felt two solid taps. So neither Amy nor the audience can figure out how the other is rationalizing the event.
Amy thinks the audience is amazed that she felt it at all. The audience thinks Amy is a psychic receiver.
It is a stunning, weaponized manipulation of shared chronology.
And it works flawlessly because the human brain is fundamentally a meaning-making machine. When we are in a social setting, our brains automatically, unconditionally assume a shared linear timeline of events.
We just assume everyone is experiencing the same now.
Right. We assume that if we're all standing in the same room, breathing the same air, we're all experiencing the exact same now. The performer is acting as a live video editor, literally splicing two completely different timelines together in real time to manufacture an impossible narrative.
That is the perfect way to describe it. It's an audiovisual desync. It's as if Amy is experiencing the live broadcast feed, but the audience is watching the event on a 10-second tape delay.
And the performer is sitting in the control room.
Yes. Splicing the delayed video feed of Kate being tapped with the live audio feed of Amy saying, "I felt it," and broadcasting that impossible composite reality to the room.
And this dual reality architecture isn't just used for a simple touch on the hand. The texts detail far more elaborate applications.
Like what?
There's a routine called the lift, where a blindfolded participant's arm magically, smoothly rises into the air at the exact moment the performer, standing across the stage, raises his own arm like a puppet master.
Yes. And an even crazier one called synchronized drinking, designed for dinner parties.
Oh, that one's brilliant.
Five guests are seated around a table. A subject who has supposedly been hypnotized takes a sip from his wine glass at the exact fraction of a second. Another guest across the table decides to take a sip, seemingly entirely through deep hypnotic rapport.
The underlying mechanism for both of these miracles is brilliantly pragmatic and relies heavily on controlling the physical, unseen environment.
It's all happening under the table, right?
In both cases, yes. The performer and the subject, whether they are blindfolded or hypnotized, are seated at a table. Crucially, the table must have a tablecloth that drapes all the way down to the floor. Under the cover of that tablecloth, the performer secretly places the tip of his shoe on top of the subject's foot and presses down.
Right, and he sets up a hidden set of rules during the initial setup or hypnotic induction. He whispers to the subject, "As long as you feel this pressure on your foot, your hand is glued to the table. But the exact moment the pressure disappears, you will smoothly lift your arm."
Or in the drinking routine, when the pressure releases, pick up your glass and take a sip of your wine.
So let's look at the split reality above the table. The audience sees the performer staring intensely, silently at a completely different guest, waiting for that guest to casually lift their glass.
The moment the guest decides to drink, the performer subtly shifts his body weight, releasing the pressure on the subject's foot under the table.
The subject feels the cue and immediately takes a sip.
The audience sees miraculous telepathic synchronization. The subject just thinks they are following a simple physical cue as part of an exercise. Dual reality. It is breathtaking in its simplicity and its audacity.
However, as the literature points out, a mentalist doesn't always have the luxury or the need to construct a fake reality using physical cues, secret taps, or hidden foot pressure.
No, sometimes they don't have to force anything.
Sometimes they don't need to force anything at all. They just have to look very closely at the reality the subject's own body is involuntarily revealing to them.
The human body is constantly betraying the mind if you have the education to know what to look for.
This transitions us perfectly into the realm of physiology and reading unconscious betrayals. We are talking about neurolinguistic programming, or NLP, which features heavily in these texts.
NLP is a massive part of this.
There is a breakdown of an effect called divining a memory that relies entirely on something NLP researchers call eye-accessing cues.
To understand this, we have to look at the neurology proposed by NLP. The theory posits that when humans access different types of stored sensory memories, our eyes involuntarily move in highly specific directions.
So where we look tells you what we are thinking about.
Basically, it's an unavoidable neurological reflex related to cognitive load and how the brain retrieves data. The conscious mind is busy trying to dig up the sensory data, and the neurology connecting the brain to the optic nerves forces a physiological response in the eyes.
So the practical application is this. The performer asks the spectator to write down three distinct, highly detailed memories on three slips of paper. Memory one is a vivid image of an old friend's face. Memory two is a favorite song. Memory three is a time they were in intense physical pain.
Okay, three very different sensory experiences.
The spectator secretly hides two of the papers and keeps one crumpled up in their fist. The performer just looks at their face, asks them to think about the memory, and instantly knows which of the three they're holding. How?
By analyzing the mechanical dashboard of the human face, the performer asks them to visualize the exact, granular details of the memory. According to the NLP theory outlined in the manual, if the subject is recalling a visual memory, like the specific facial features of that old friend, their eyes will naturally, involuntarily dart upwards into the side, accessing the visual cortex.
Up into the side.
If they're recalling an auditory memory, trying to hear the song in their head, their eyes will move laterally, side to side, straight toward the ears.
Toward the ears, that makes sense.
And if they are accessing a kinesthetic memory, trying to recall the feeling of touch or physical pain, their eyes will look down and to the right.
With the vital, terrifying caveat that if the person is left-handed, their neurological wiring mirrors these directions.
Exactly. You have to know their handedness first.
So the performer just has to establish their handedness, say, visualize the memory, watch their eyes flick up toward the ceiling for a millisecond, and confidently say, you're thinking of your friend.
To the audience, it looks like literal telepathy. But in reality, the performer is just reading the biological machinery.
Precisely. And this analytical approach extends to speech reading as well. There is a deeply fascinating technique described where the performer asks the subject to think of a word, but gives them a very specific, paradoxical instruction. Say the word out loud in your head.
Which, if you think about it, is such a weird, almost nonsensical instruction. Say it out loud in your head.
It's a beautifully crafted paradox designed to force a physical action. By instructing the subject to internally articulate the word loudly, rather than just picturing it, the performer forces the subject's brain to engage the micromusculature of their vocal tract.
The brain actually sends a signal to the throat and lips to form the word, even if no sound comes out.
The performer then focuses entirely on watching the lips and the throat. They are looking specifically for what linguists call bilabial sounds, letters like P, B, and M.
Because you can't say them without your lips touching.
Try it right now if you're listening. Try to make a P or B sound without bringing your lips together. You literally cannot do it. The mechanics of the sound require the lips to touch.
So it's a visible tell.
Yes. So if the performer asks you to think of a geometric shape and they see your lips quickly, subtly pressed together, they know instantly you are internally sounding out a word with a P, B, or M in it. You're not thinking of a circle or a square. You're thinking of a pentagon.
Or a parallelogram.
Exactly. Or if they ask you to think of an animal and your lips don't move at all, but your throat subtly flexes and swallows, they know you're using back-of-the-tongue guttural sounds like K or G. Maybe a kangaroo or a cat.
The entire premise relies on exploiting the fact that humans are terrible at hiding cognitive load. When we think hard about a specific sensory memory or try to internally articulate a complex word, our body leaks information like a sieve.
And it gets even more microscopic than lip reading. The text breaks down the classic coin-in-hand trick. You know, guessing which fist a spectator is hiding a coin in.
It sounds like a 50-50 guessing game.
But the manual says the performer just looks for a genuine eye twitch. But here is the catch. You have to know the difference between a real neurological twitch and a fake one.
People try to fake it to throw you off.
A fake twitch, where the spectator is actively trying to trick you by blinking the wrong eye, is slow. It's conscious. A genuine subconscious twitch on the side of the body holding the heavy coin is fast. It pulses.
Fascinating.
Or the performer looks for a subconscious lip lick. The spectator will often involuntarily lick the side of their lip, corresponding to the hand holding the coin due to localized tension.
So the performer isn't guessing at all. They are analyzing a massive, real-time stream of mechanical, physiological, and statistical probabilities.
Speaking of probability, the texts briefly touch on a couple of incredibly pragmatic, almost cheeky methods that don't require deep psychological reading at all.
Clever statistic.
For example, the coin date prediction. A mentalist asks someone to pull a 10p coin out of their pocket and instantly guesses the year printed on it is 1992. It looks like clairvoyance, but it literally just relies on the economic fact that the UK Treasury minted and flooded circulation with hundreds of millions of 10p coins in 1992.
It's just a massive statistical advantage masquerading as magic.
And then there's the mechanical audacity of the Swami gimmick.
The Swami gimmick is the absolute epitome of bold physical deception. It is one of the oldest and most devastating tools in mentalism.
It's so simple, it's almost insulting. It is a tiny microscopic piece of pencil lead hidden under the performer's thumbnail, usually held there by a tiny speck of flesh-colored putty or wax.
The thumbnail writer.
The routine goes like this. The performer asks a subject to think of their four-digit bank PIN. The performer holds up a small piece of cardboard, stares intently at the subject, and pretends to write down a prediction with a pen. But they actually write nothing. They just wave the pen over the paper.
Pantomiming the writing.
Then, the performer asks the subject to say their PIN out loud for everyone to hear. Let's say the subject says 1234. The performer smiles and says, "So, it would be a miracle if I got that right."
Building a time delay.
And in that two-second delay, while everyone is processing the statement, the performer uses the hidden piece of lead under their thumbnail to secretly, blindly scribble 1234 onto the cardboard with one hand. They then flip the card around to show a perfect prediction written in pencil.
The psychological brilliance of the Swami gimmick is that the audience never, ever considers the mere existence of a hidden thumb-mounted writing device. It is entirely outside their paradigm.
They don't even know it's a possibility.
Their reality simply does not include the possibility of a pencil lead glued under a fingernail. Because they cannot conceive of the tool, they cannot deduce the method. They are left with no choice but to accept the miracle.
But wait, let me pause this whole operation for a second.
Sure, what's up?
If I am a mentalist and I am pulling all these deeply personal tells out of someone's head, if I'm watching their eyes to see if they're actively remembering physical pain, or if I'm secretly analyzing their micro-expressions or relying on statistical manipulation, isn't there a massive risk of being incredibly invasive?
That's a very real concern.
Isn't this just psychological manipulation bordering on abuse?
That is an extremely important observation, and it brings us to the profound ethical core of the source material. These texts don't just teach the tricks, they agonize over the morality of performing them.
So they do address it.
The author draws a massive, heavy line in the sand regarding the ethics of mind reading versus what is commonly known as cold reading. The texts take a highly aggressive stance against traditional cold reading.
Yeah, traditional cold reading gives me the creeps.
It's very problematic.
It's what you see fake psychics use on daytime talk shows, and it almost always relies on exploiting human insecurities or disgustingly exploiting grief.
Yes, preying on the vulnerable.
A traditional cold reader will look at someone and say, "I'm sensing that you put up a tough exterior for the world, but inside you're secretly anxious and want to be loved." Which is a Barnum statement that applies to literally 99% of the human race.
Everyone feels that way sometimes.
Or, far worse, they pretend to speak to a deceased parent or a miscarried baby, offering fake comfort in exchange for money and television ratings. The author of these manuals clearly finds that deeply unethical, manipulative, and artistically bankrupt.
Because it is a profound abuse of power. The performer is using deception not to create wonder, but to reduce the spectator's sense of self-agency. They are trapping a vulnerable human being in the performer's arbitrary and often manipulative vision of the world.
So what's the alternative?
The texts demand an alternative. The ethical approach presented here is the concept of reading situations rather than reading emotional weaknesses.
The ultimate example provided for this ethical approach is an anecdote called Pecan Pie at the Cottage. This is the blueprint for how you do it right. Imagine the performer secretly gains access to a piece of information. Maybe the subject wrote it on a piece of paper that was secretly read, or maybe the performer overheard a conversation.
Somehow they got the data.
The hidden piece of data is the phrase, pecan pie at the cottage. Now, a hack, an unethical performer, would just hold their fingers to their temples and say, the spirits are telling me you're thinking of pecan pie at a cottage. It's boring and it's just a puzzle.
It reduces the interaction back to a cheap trick. The intellect immediately asks, how did he peek at the paper?
Exactly. But the ethical, artistic approach, the method championed by these texts, is to build a vivid, deductive, Sherlock Holmes-style reading based on that one tiny piece of data.
Constructing a narrative around it.
The performer looks at the subject and begins to construct a narrative. They deduce that pecan pie is a fairly complex, rich dessert, not usually something a toddler eats. So the subject was probably a bit older when this memory formed, maybe around 8 or 9 years old.
That's a smart deduction.
The cottage implies a secondary location, a holiday home, not a primary residence in a city. So the performer describes seeing a woodland setting, maybe a lake, the warmth of summertime, a large family gathering.
Building the scene.
Furthermore, pecan pie is usually homemade, so the performer deduces and warmly suggests that the subject's mother or grandmother must be a very creative, excellent, loving cook.
Look at the difference in the impact there.
Okay.
The performer is taking a pragmatic piece of gathered intelligence and using it to construct a beautiful, personalized, and entirely flattering narrative. They are giving the subject a gift of a vivid memory.
They outline the exact same philosophy with the dental appointment story. In this scenario, the performer accidentally glances at a guy's open diary on a desk and sees a scribbled note. Dental apt, Dr. Garten, along with a full street address and a distant area code.
Mundane data.
Instead of doing the cheap trick and saying you're going to the dentist today, the performer translates this mundane data into a fascinating psychic vision.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the performer looks at the man and says, I see a garden in your mouth. Playing poetically on the doctor's name, garden.
A garden in your mouth, wow.
They note that the full street address is written down, which implies the subject hasn't been there before, so the performer deduces it's a new dentist. They see the distant area code, so they state, I sense you have a long journey ahead of you today.
It's just logically parsing the clues.
And finally, they analyze the confident, heavy handwriting of the note to suggest, but I sense you are entirely unafraid of whatever procedure you are facing.
It's brilliant. It's literally Sherlock Holmes masquerading as a psychic.
Precisely. And the vital ethical distinction here is that while the method snooping in a diary or peeking at a hidden slip of paper is entirely pragmatic, opportunistic, and deceptive, the presentation of that deception is highly respectful.
It empowers the subject.
The performer uses the trickery to validate the subject's own life experiences and bolster their confidence, rather than asserting dominance over their psyche or exploiting their insecurities.
It takes a cheap trick and elevates it into poetry, which leads us perfectly into the final, most beautiful story in the material. The story of Debbie Boone and the rose petals.
This is the absolute ultimate example of this ethical, theatrical philosophy in action.
This routine utilizes a classic mechanical sleight of hand card move called the Figaro transfer, where a playing card is secretly swaps from one hand to the other right in front of the audience's eyes.
Right, it's a very technical move.
But instead of just using the move to change a two of clubs into a king of spades so the audience claps and says, cool trick, the performer weaves the physical move into a deeply human, vulnerable story.
Giving it a reason to exist.
He stands in front of the audience and talks about being 6 years old. He talks about trying to impress his childhood crush, a little girl named Debbie Boone, by doing a magic trick where he produces a beautiful rose from his sleeve.
A childhood memory.
But he was a kid, the trick failed, the rose fell apart, the petals scattered on the floor, and everyone laughed at him. He ties this universal story of childhood heartbreak and embarrassment to the card trick happening right now.
Setting the emotional stakes.
A spectator picks the two of hearts, the literal classic symbol of love. The performer holds the card up at his fingertips. He executes the Figaro transfer, but instead of the card just disappearing or changing into another card, the Two of Hearts visually instantly dissolves into a shower of real blood-red rose petals that flutter down onto the table.
It is a breathtaking piece of theater. It transforms a mass-produced piece of printed cardboard into a poignant, visceral symbol of lost innocence and magical redemption.
It's just beautiful.
It creates a moment of pure art. And I think this perfectly summarizes the entire philosophical approach we've uncovered in these texts today. Whether a mentalist is using a mathematically stacked deck of cards to force a losing hand, or tracing a backward three in the air to subliminally hack your subconscious choices, or employing the terrifying mechanics of dual reality to shatter the timeline of a room.
The underlying mechanics must always, always be hidden beneath a layer of deep, profound respect for the audience's intelligence and their emotional capacity.
Exactly. The respect is what makes it magic instead of a prank.
So as we wrap this up, what does this all mean for us? It means that true magic isn't about the props. It's not about the playing cards, the gimmicked coins, or the hidden pieces of pencil lead glued to a thumbnail. It's about the profound, sometimes terrifying, and utterly beautiful malleability of the human mind.
Yeah, it really is.
It's about how deeply we want to feel astonishment, and how willing we are to believe and wonder if only someone treats us with enough respect to build the illusion properly.
And I think it leaves us with a final, perhaps slightly unsettling thought to ponder long after this deep dive is over.
Oh, I'm ready. What is it?
We've spent all this time examining how easily our perception of reality can be split by a hidden tap on the hand, or how our choices can be completely dictated by a backward number drawn in the air while we are distracted. It forces us to ask a bigger question.
Okay.
Outside of a magic show, in the real world, how much of our everyday reality, the products we choose to buy at the grocery store, the politicians we decide to trust, the deeply held memories we cherish, is actually constructed by the invisible cues, the framing, and the subliminal forces surrounding us every single day?
That is a terrifying thought.
The ultimate magic trick isn't what happens on a stage. It's the illusion of our own uninfluenced free will.
That is absolutely something that will keep you awake at night. If you're listening to this, thank you for being here. Thank you for taking this deep dive into the architecture of wonder with us.
Yeah.
And the next time you're at a loud, chaotic dinner party and a stranger sits next to you and quietly asks you to think of a childhood memory, maybe keep a very close eye on what their hands are doing.